This is John Brandy's third visit to St. Louis, the second here at Duff's. He's made a lot of friends over the time of those visits. He comes to us from New Mexico and is well-traveled in the poetry wars. His travels have taken him to the tundras of Alaska, the rainforests of Central America, the mountain peaks of the Himalayas, the urban jungles of Asia. He has had a variety of jobs over that period, from a cannery packer to a Peace Corps worker to an itinerant poet and teacher. He frequently does workshops now in his native Southwest in the tribal areas. I have many wonderful memories with John, attending the home dance on the Hopi Reservation, walking up Monk's Mound on Cahokia, a baptismal rite in the Rio Grande River near rolling over in the mud of the Rio Grande near his home. John has Muley Point, looking at rain clouds gathering over Navajo Mountain from a place called Muley Point. As a writer and as a human being, John has a great sense of wonder and mystery and humanity. He's published many books, most recently Hymn for a Night Feast, Shadow Play, and what's the name of that little book of wonderful haiku that's over there? Weeding the Cosmos. He's a wonderful haiku as well as a narrative and lyrical poet. It's always a joy to bring him before a poetry audience. Please welcome him back to Duff's and to St. Louis, John Brandy.
Okay, I'm here. Thank you. Seems like since I prepare only for what ought to happen, I'm never really prepared for what does happen, ever. And I'm perhaps least prepared than I've ever been this time around. But seems like poets have a habit of breaking rules. And I do know that a teacher, actually a longtime friend now, gave me the whole operating arena in poetry at one point, told me that one never begins. Well, the first poem you read is always a giveaway poem. No one's listening. They're checking you out. You're checking them out. Second thing is never begin with a long poem because they won't take it. They won't put up with it. And because I love to break rules and because I am sort of an outlaw, I guess, and we all are in one respect or another, I think I'm going to simply disregard his agenda and begin with this poem that I read on Michael's radio program the other night called Old Beast Self. And the reason I wanted to start with this is because so many of us, myself included, love to complain in life. I think there's a way to transform complaints into more positive, expressive, affirmative energy. And so don't walk out when you hear the list of complaints because they do tend to change in the poem. This is called Old Beast Self. Trees named, flowers named, continents named, bomb sites memorialized, road signs quadrupled, thunder rerouted, lightning detoured, weather televised, music canned, dog meat canned, uranium canned, Walt Disney frozen, Billy the Kid's body stolen, outer space wired, blackbirds poisoned, Popeye painted on warheads, electrocution sanctioned, phone wires tapped, geysers tapped, volcanoes monitored, terrorism mass-marketed, crime popularized, burglary syndicated, lies memorized, death squads okayed, rainforests mapped, fir trees under contract, inlets earmarked, cows branded, knowledge booked, books shredded, time put into ticks, ticks digitalized, goodwill fossilized, mythology vandalized, honesty scrutinized, planet light eyed by marketing executives, chins, noses, breasts rearranged in surgery rooms, bodies mugged, straights plugged, flags pinned to the other side of the moon, scientists, poets, nuns silenced, hearts transplanted, satellites repaving the night sky, earthworms boxed and sold, crocodiles skinned, counselors, therapists, mail course astrologers, dissecting people's lives. Help. I want my body back. I want my old beast self. I want a voice that sings, high altitude clear. I want to live without being watched. I want to smile without being choked, bathe myself unmonitored, sleep without someone ringing my number. I want to make love without being told how to do it, what to feel, how to wake the next morning, what time of day it is, who's in the World Series, who's winning the latest war, who's been left in purgatory and not gone to heaven. Stop! Let me lose myself for once. Let me see who I am. Empty pockets of driver's license, spare change, social security, draft card, secret phone numbers, fake student ID, Visa, and master charge. I want to eat without additives, die without preservatives. I want to rise from the world's debris, wipe the rusted mirror, have a feast. I want to feel my body naked, wet with storm, stuck with pollen, tanned with meteor fire, soused with cold rain. I want to pass through Halley's tail, bloom, shake my mane, stretch the stiff joints, roll in the mustard, kick my heels, silver the dry wash with rafts of light, unbloody the ocean, unsmoke the stack, undo the noose, unframe the framed, let loose the shadows, lick the salt from the world's tears, no flags, no heads ruling hearts, no dirty clothes piled in the closet, no bomb hatch on the horizon. Let me flood through the gate, slide into you, embrace without could-bes. I want it 100 times the first time. I want it slow, in the open, luminous, sourceless, as books never tell it, as vision never witnesses it. I want it blessed by the brightest angel. I want it in the clover, in the clouds, with a furious taste of electricity, with silence left in my lungs, with my windshield steamed. I want it high on a green wet wave, and the whole world with me, out, in, back, through the narrow vent of birth. Then to sleep, to drift, to wake, beckoned by no absence, collective and unnamed, feathered, horned, soft-pawed, haloed, blood song in the veins, bird whistle in the artery, fin in surf spray, I want it. Heaven knows where. I want my body back. I want my old beast self. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. This is for the Chilean surrealist Vicente Huidobro. I think he died about 1948. In 1916, he gave a lecture in Buenos Aires on the theory of creativity. He called himself a creationist rather than a poet. And in this lecture, he simply stated the three conditions of a poet. Condition number one being that a poet must create. Condition number two, a poet must create. And the third condition of a poet is to create. And that was his lecture. So this is for Vicente Huidobro and everybody that's beginning to write down fragments of the outside-inside vision. Write the heaven of now. Write the lost paradise of memory's shrine. Write the teeth of darkness and the white of silence. Write the star, the thicket, the plum tree. Write a whirligig. Write foreplay. Write to see straight. Write to forget your name. Write no dogma. Write objects beyond thought for little reward. Write the cup and saucer before you. Write a leaf. Write a fig tree. Write the table's leg. Write the mirror that prisms the air and gives back your secret shape. Thank you. So St. Louis is always a wonderful place, and I really want to thank all of you. It's full of old and new experiences and wonderful people that seem to continuously slip through the cracks in the great webs of stars that are above us and all the coral reefs we stand on. I want to dedicate this to Angie. This is a poem, not about Angie, but for Angie, who gave me the little talisman here somewhere in my pocket, that wonderful silver catwoman that I guess I'm supposed to put this in my daughter's ear when I get home. Anyway, she seems to have the reincarnation of the spirit of a very, very favorite student of mine out in California. I gave a workshop at Idlewild up in the mountains behind Los Angeles recently, and at the end of the workshop, usually all my students read to me and I read to them. And then everybody's mother comes or father comes in a Mercedes or BMW or an old Plymouth station wagon, and then they disappear out of the forests back into the bowels of Los Angeles. So this poem is simply called Out of Control and Untitled in the Forest of Mozart. And you will remember, of course, that morning we took to the woods to smoke our long blue clove cigarettes, the way you edged in and out of your shoes, hustling a chilly ray in the squirrel heat of day as pine needles splintered your eyes while you read Purple Void of Satisfaction under the snowflake sun of Rimbaud and chalked your strings with a hefty vibrato of Mozart in a pool of dragonflies. You cried a blank halo on the page, and your eyes opened wide, set with silver on two white tablecloths. How clearly your kneecaps filled with bullets, how fantastic Blake's tiger looked in bed with Longfellow. And the bride of fire in her torn jeans, and the bride of autographs in her Mercedes, and the dancing wall of velvet that coughed straight A's on mother's couch, so hot with love lines fed into a cocked earful of moons. You spelled Hebrew in Spanish, cursed my shivering corrections, and kept conformity at low tide. I think it's cheesy. I think it's corny. I think it's daddy under disguise inside mommy who's come for you undercover as God in a cold shadow, making everything you touch here for the first time. A word, a grenade, a tree line moving through snow. So thank you. You've broken my fast. I'm lighting this cigarette under an ultraviolet sky and calling it a night before the day becomes too long and the wind breaks my cloud. Thank you. This was written a few years ago between, you may recognize some of these places if you know Buffalo, New York. Which is way out west from New York City. It takes a long time to get to New York City from Buffalo, but at one point I was traveling in this area and stopping to reside for a while and work with students who were lugging these heavy barnacled anchors full of poems from workshop to workshop saying, what can I do? And I would say, throw them out, write something new, have some new experiences. And anyway, I began to compose letters back home to people in New Mexico, many of them which never got sent. And I think this might be to my daughter, but I never really found out to whom it was written. I am amazed. I see you in a dream, and you are entertaining me. We are both very young. Everything is in color except the two parentheses floating slightly above, like fragments of vegetation in a Max Ernst painting. And then I write a poem that has nothing to do with a dream. I scribble extra fine fade-proof lines into my notebook on bridges inside tunnels. I sit in a cathedral, sharpening pencil shavings into my pants cuff while security guards fondle their walkie-talkies. And it's a perfect day, just to be nobody, to examine the ghost inside my eye or the periwinkle bobbing its face to the woofing pile driver three blocks away. And there's a nice shade of green on the eyelids of the waitress who spills my coffee, watching the guy out the window behind his easel making the invisible a possibility. Life is full of details, the present tense of past history, the dreamy substance of philosophy, a dog walking its owner past glassy storefronts filled with powdered antlers and seahorses upside down in a bowl. And I am just stepping along, part of the scenario, fighting off the urge to wear a green cape and pink jockstrap when my daughter brings her friends to meet me. But anyway, listening to the former Miss America get sent up for grand larceny is just as good. I love the big city hall, so phallic and art deco, all lit up at night when you drive in from the Canadian side. It's so good to feel free, but I get dizzy often. I lost my equilibrium at Niagara Falls, got sick on the Eiffel Tower. But I'm shaping up in my old age, like I want to see the Liberace sequin collection and catch Khrushchev pounding his shoe in the Toledo Wax Museum. I'll probably finish the day walking up the street across the lake to see the latest exhibit, maybe end up eating bonbons in front of the screen, remembering the big scribbly heads of Jean Dubuffet. Then I'll brew some tea and fall asleep. There'll be noises upstairs, lovers gently wooing one another, making seismographic waves in the park across the street. I'll set my wristwatch, dream of notes like Charlie Parker. The windows will steam, sun will rise above the theater and trolley cars, over river docks where Chinese shopping bag ladies and meteorologists in plastic raincoats and the Quaker Oats-looking man under the clock tower with a French-Canadian nun will be talking in perfect circles. Yes, it's already morning. 24 hours have passed. I'm licking this closed. I just wanted you to know I'm glad for the new bridge and the way they fixed the airport. It's so convenient. And the styles they're wearing make me think we live in a really big city. One last thing. You know, when the colored lights came on that time at the falls, how the water actually seemed to be stopped, not going up or down? Well, it's similar to a shift in color when you paint, how an effect is created in the eye, and what is seen, though it is really moving, appears to be absolutely still. I remember how we blinked at each other, how everybody around us was just shadows. There was a big burst of flash bulbs, and for a moment we saw 16 Japanese men against a granite rail, each holding an empty rubber camera case looped around his wrist. And then it was dark again, full of mist coming up from below and the sound of airplanes flying above. Remember, I was starting to tell you how we were both very young and you were entertaining me. It was at the beginning. Everything was black and white, as I recall. except the two parentheses. Or maybe I am mistaken, and we are not those same people. Thank you. This was a poem that came about after blowing it. Really, I dropped all my current manuscripts in a windstorm in elementary school in the middle of this terrible dust and tumbleweed chaos, and it just flew all over the place. And I really didn't want people to see what I was working on. It hurt, kind of. And then I thought, well, why not celebrate it? Because there's something magical and happy when words just exist as they are for you rather than from you. I mean, they're no longer your own. And this was just a literal incident which proved the point. And it's simply called, "All My Poems Stood Up. All the mistakes and crossouts, all the loose ends, the bloodstains and pornographies, everything rising in one giant whirlwind, all the blue times and the yellow, all the enlightened stanzas of hope, the precisely heard gossipy tidbits, blew through the schoolyard, rose in delirium, all the Gnostic couplets, the imitation tankas and open verse, free-form sonnets and calculated risks, climbed an airy ladder and did their own thing. All the erasures and radical tilts, overworked disasters, backward walking iambic pentameter, spun into a cyclone, laughed looking down, the juicy parables, the passionate whimsies, the ultra-private fantasies, got up and freed themselves with wings of their own. All the words I thought were mine, the pearly stanzas and meticulous quatrains, the double dance of imagery, whirled into one dynamic entity for the whole world to see. All my poems, out of reach, just space in time, danced bare naked in wild, spontaneous harmony." This, I thought I would read, it's a change of pace, it's maybe a long preface to a short poem, but the poem is called "At Wovoka's Ghost Dance Place." And in the 1890s, the Paiute son of a prophet in Nevada, what is now Nevada, received a vision, and the vision told Wovoka that harmony would once again be possible between all peoples, but first there would have to be a cleansing, that a great flood would come and wipe away those Anglo-Europeans who are responsible for the terrible genocide against his tribe and many of the Native Americans, most of the Native Americans. In the vision, he was told that the buffalo would come back, that the deceased would return to earth. Basically, there would be a great rejuvenation of all species. And the key to the vision was that there was to be a solidarity created amongst Native Americans through song and through dance, through ceremonialism. And once this began, and it began along what is today called the Walker River, south of Reno in Nevada, south of Carson City, actually. It flows out of the Sierra Nevada. Once this began, a great momentum began with it, and it terrified the non-Indians. They could not understand the magic of the song. They feared the solidarity of the people. When it finally spread to the Dakotas, the Dakotas very fervently embraced the ghost dance. And one of the more famous and definitely the most tragic incident connected with the ghost dance was when a band of about 300 Dakotas were on their way to the Badlands to join the rest of their tribe to participate in a ghost dance. And of course, they were surrounded and forced they were marched back to the nearest government agency by the 7th Cavalry, and one of their stopping points was Wounded Knee. And when the men, women, old people, babies, children woke up, all the young mothers in the morning, on that cold morning, they were wiped out with Hotchkiss rifles, I believe. And for this act, this slaughtering of over 300 people, I believe the 7th Cavalry eventually was awarded 26 congressional medals of honor. So I went to the place where Wovoka began the ghost dance, and this is, again, this is a short poem, but it was my feeling about this place. I blow dandelion heads across Wovoka's ghost dance place. Hear tractors whine through alfalfa fields. Hear the call of deer continuing history. Feel moment to moment the river's bend, shift of jet stream bringing rain, heat in snakes moving across highway. I bow to magpies drinking in light from dark old sediment, to grass waving with resilience, to the force of everything here long before us, the way it was and how it'll come back to be, yielding, yielding to all of it that has yielded me. And this, thank you. I seem to make a frugal living as a poet in residence, sleeping on pushed-together desktops throughout the West, Alaska and New Mexico, Nevada, Montana in particular. Every year for the last 6 years, I've been working with the Diné, the Navajo people, around Shiprock, New Mexico, and between the years, I guess, 86 and 89, I wrote this poem, which is called I Saw Kit Carson Still Alive. And if you've been out to New Mexico, you know there are a lot of restaurants, inns, motels, street signs, national forests named after Kit Carson. There are many, many majestic mountain peaks which somehow don't retain their Native American names but are named things like Mount Harvard, Mount Yale, Mount Princeton. Mountains named after institutions. It's nuts. And, of course, Kit Carson in the 1860s was the colonel in the United States Army, the paramount figure responsible for the campaign against the Navajo, destroy the crops, destroy the livestock, destroy the language and the culture if anybody resists, and they're to be shot. And I found an Encyclopedia Britannica that had this quote about Kit Carson in it. He was a likable, soft-spoken man whose exploits contributed much toward the settlement of the West. And this poem, though maybe you won't or maybe you will recognize some of the place names, attempts to bring Kit Carson up to date and maybe put some of this in perspective. I saw Kit Carson still alive, cruising the reservation, driving through Window Rock, up over the hill towards Naschitti and Biklabito, the consumer producer, vending obsolescence, measuring people in units of profit, reading the desert as one vast printout. I saw him step from an eagle, the BIA official from back east, looking for points to advance his career. He was the relocation agent eyeing hillsides, surveying canyons, planning quick development housing, calling long distance to line up friends for under-the-table contracts. I saw him, watched him at Black Mesa, saw him at Shiprock, pulling the brake at Colonel Sanders, cleaning his carbon on a Formica table, bulldozing peach trees, handing out free radioactive mine tailings, telling the people of Powati, here, make your adobes, build new foundations. He was in Tohatchee and many farms, marching school kids through freezing rain to salute the flag. He was holed up in a town named after Cortez, the liquor retailer, sitting up late designing billboards showing a tight-jeaned woman beckoning men with an open blouse and outstretched arm holding a bottle of Tokay. He swiveled in his chair, downshifted into third, rode a glass elevator high above the world 3,000 miles away. I saw him slip into his saddle, unfold his maps, spit dusk outside Paradise Disco, pass out Bibles under a portable placard saying, First Indian Free Will Full Gospel Pre-Millennium Church of God. He cocked his hat, timed his watch. His infrared cigarette burned down into the night. He talked low, made camp, built a Hogan-shaped saloon with his brother-in-law 100 yards from the reservation boundary. He was the one who grabbed Mrs. Yazzie by her velveteen collar and pushed her into the snow when she came to save her husband from another night of drinking. I saw him, Kit Carson, working the gears and levers way up high behind the scoop of his $3 million power shovel, training men to dig up the land, trade in the old ways, mine coal, get a job with Sacred Mountain Electric. He was the power plant industrialist, breaking for lunch at Best Western Inn. He polished his spurs, got a shave, had a girl sent up to his room. He was there generating sulfurous haze over cornfields and rivers, spilling waste into drinking holes and village wells. He was busy manufacturing electricity for Los Angeles and Phoenix, the gambling halls of Vegas, the used car lots and nuke sites. I saw him down low behind the tinted windows of his Cougar, secretly jotting notes for his PhD. Writing a book to size things up. In Tuba City, in Round Rock, he was there, bribing Indian leaders, buying off tribal officials to pave inroads for corporate bosses to confuse the Athapascan grandmother and steal her land. He was getting rich on radioactive disposal, on Pampers, on lethal 1080 used to wipe out coyote. He kicked dust from his hooves, climbed Defiance Plateau in his four-wheeler, had a picnic at Washington Pass, looking down into wide expanse of red desert and brown mesas. He spied through field glasses and licked his chops. On the highways, in the bars, it was 1864, 1878, 1964, 1992. I saw him. Kit Carson, he was still there doing his thing. Thank you. Thank you. That, in 1864, about 8,500 to 9,000 of the Navajo people were marched some 300 miles from what would be about Window Rock, Arizona to Fort Sumner, New Mexico. And the other date, 1878, that's when the boarding school plot was designed to take Native Americans off their land and educate them in the Anglo ways. 1964 was when certain progressives were bribed and Peabody Coal took over Black Mesa for 30 years. So the strip mining continues, and it'll be up for renewal here pretty soon. This was written for my granddaughter, and she was born 3 years ago in August, and I'll simply read what I wrote. Right. It was quite a beautiful experience to be at your child's birth, I mean, you know, you see this strange new being emerging into the world, and then you're holding her, and another strange new being is emerging into the world, and so it was really quite powerful. The pathway shines. May the power of breath, love, and courage be with you. From your mother's house, you slip out to fill the gate, to become visible, truly here. Breathe, little one. Rearrange the world with your smile. Bring rain to the garden. Carry with you always the light from which you've taken hold. Remind us that we are an echo, forever arriving into the dream called life. Praise the mystery as together we swim this stream. Let us live fully and truthfully as we begin our return to the house from which all things are born. Thank you. I think I'll read this a couple from Alaska. This one, if I can find it here, written in a whiteout, and a good place to write a poem. Most of them are written there anyway. I was waiting for a plane in what turned out to be a raging, raging blizzard, and I was up in a very, very northern part of the Yupik Eskimo area in Alaska. I had to get from a small landing strip to a larger landing strip to an even larger one. And so I was waiting with a bunch of Eskimo people for the single-engined plane to appear out of the snowstorms at about 75 feet and land and pick us all up and try to get us to Dillingham, Alaska on in Bristol Bay. And it turned out that when the plane landed and all the natives had a chance to check out who was flying the plane, every one of them picked up their gear and split. They didn't want to fly with this person. And I guess I just had to go with it. And so I loaded my footlocker into the plane. We had to get the door open with a screwdriver. It was jammed shut. Got the compartment closed, and we began to fly, and then I realized just what I was in for, since probably less than 4 minutes after takeoff, the young man who was from Sweden, might have been in his early 20s, got a operating manual from the dashboard and began to read it and asked me to check the weather out of the left-hand side of the fuselage. So anyway, it was a slow, cautious flight, and I don't know how many times he had been up there, but I got to the larger airport and then took a 737 to Chicago and landed in Chicago, and it was still snowing. I still couldn't see anything. And the poem has nothing to do with any of this. It's called One Plus One Plus One Plus one plus one equals one. And it's for my good friend Nanao Sakaki, the great 65-year-old Japanese poet and wanderer. No east, no west, no south, no north, no center, no space that surrounds, no word, no song, no wing, no stone, no ground, no door, no room, no star, no flesh, no bone, no pain, no flotsam of human centuries, no crack of whip nor shot of gun, no womb, no ocean, no phallus, no cloud, no bicycle, no boat, no oar, no wave, no bomb, no wind, no flower, no ash circling from fire, no radio, nothing named, no beginning, no end, no middle, nothing latched, no sonnet battling free form, no game, nothing won nor lost. No Bible, no Tarot, no Veda, no Gilgamesh, no step just taken or about to be made, no vapor, no shine, no darkness, no crime, no meaning under the tongue, no blame, no automobile, no tomb, no skyscraper, nothing dirty, nothing clean, no this nor that, no be or not to be, no me, no you, no them, no us, no brain, no body, no arms to reach, nor finger to explode. No everything, no nothing, no yes, no no. This one I'd like to... Ira, a great traveler that he is, and we've been having a lot of fun this week reading together and recalling ancient memories from India and Kathmandu, so maybe he'll appreciate this, and I think everybody might, because it seems like this ephemeral, unidentifiable figure that we seem to see in so many places, but still in the end, she remains nameless, is always with us. I've seen her as the dancer, I've seen her as the muse, I've seen her as the open-armed Virgin of Guadalupe with her blue and gold vestments from my youth. She's appeared along the Ganges with her begging bowl, 10 toes on 1 foot. I've seen her in Peru carrying a bag of charcoal. I've seen her in the Museum of Modern Art, the Deva, wearing black pearls, and still I don't know her name. And so this poem is to her, written in India, 1982, in Kanchipuram. Saw you in a flight of bees through the rice-sprinkled door of Kali's shrine. Saw you in springtime thunderbolt void, waves splashing the diamond shore of Shiva's beach. Saw you turn in sleep, transparent in timeless consciousness, swimming through the world's tricks. Saw you at the balcony, watching the undoings of men, body smoking, hair falling like water. Saw you. Saw you empty dreaming eyes of holy trance, arms reaching through the painted haze of reality. Saw you and heard the unborn singing as I wrapped myself into you. Saw you take from me a key, a ring, a saber, a mirage, a bouquet of milky light. Saw you and saw through you a mirror, a clock, a child sleeping at the end of night. And thank you. Sometimes these poems, I often think that they're memories, or people think that the poet writes a memory, and I think it's more like they're the word made flesh, that the poems are reincarnations of people. And we often don't want to write, what we want to, but we write these poems, or the poems write themselves, out of necessity, because they're a way of keeping a moment or a person immortal. And certainly this poem is somewhat in that vein. It's called A Poem for Green. It's pretty self-explanatory. It's a love poem, but it's pretty self-explanatory in the first stanza. It's about a young woman who is blind, and she is slowly going deaf. A poem for green. You speak of fear, silence, the nothingness of being blind and slowly going deaf. You remember yourself as an Egyptian queen who could turn half animal, half human by rubbing an eye. You walk me through the roses into an orchard You braid my hair, say, touch me all over. I close my eyes, trying to know what it's like not to see ahead. You ask me to describe green, but my mouth won't open. My fingers reach for your hand. I find a harbor smooth as lacquer and bees in an ocean of sun. You ask me to begin a poem about love. You say, start with green as we search for fallen pecans with our bare toes at the edge of the orchard. And this one, the thing I'm finding is that, as we get older, there are more and more people that seem to be dropping out. I mean, passing away. And there was a very, very powerful woman in Santa Fe, a longtime 20-year friend. She had a brain tumor. It all caught up with her, the mortality. And in 1 week, she finally said that she was going to go off meditation and off medication. But she had one great desire, and that was that she wanted to marry the man of her dreams. So in 1 week, she invited all of the close friends to her. Well, she had to get divorced first. So she got divorced.